The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 26, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good to see everybody. Good to see everybody on Zoom. I was reading a book by Thich Nhat Hanh recently, the Heart of Buddhist Teachings, and there's a story in there that I thought might be interesting to look into a little bit, a touching story of him recalling his childhood. And that particular story reminded me of a story of the Buddha, actually. So these two kind of parallel stories that I thought I'd couple together and talk about a little bit this morning. And also a little bit of Suzuki Roshi's teachings. I'll sort of weave a chapter in from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind into this as well. I think most people know most of these teachers. Thich Nhat Hanh is a Vietnamese born teacher. He passed away just recently, and just a very influential figure in Zen Buddhism. Suzuki Roshi, you may recognize that book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. That's a seminal text. He's a modern day Zen master from the 20th century. So, and then of course the Buddha. I think we all recognize that name. But I'll just read this story from Thich Nhat Hanh's book. Again, from the Heart of Buddhist Teachings. He says, as children growing up in central Vietnam, my brothers, sisters, and I used to run out into the yard every time it rained. It was our way of taking a shower. We were so happy. Sometime later, our mother would call us and serve a bowl of rice with pickled bean sprouts or salty fish. We'd take our bowls and sit in the doorway, eating and continuing to watch the rain falling down. We were free of all worries and anxieties, not thinking about the past, the present, or the future, or anything at all. We were just enjoying ourselves, our food, and each other. On New Year's Day, Mother served us special cakes. We went outside to eat the cakes while playing with the dog and cat. Sometimes our New Year's clothes were so starchy that they squeaked as we walked. We thought we were in paradise. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, even today, you and I can return to this peace every time we breathe in and out mindfully. Our true home is this present now. So I thought, I don't know, when I read this, was just had a kind of warm quality to it, but then also a wisdom in there that it's maybe a little hard to pin down. You got to think of wisdom as we think of it in the Western world, kind of maybe as somebody who, you know, wise character who's sort of dispensing judgment, you know, to try to alleviate some sort of situation, or somebody's kind of quick-witted or something like that. But here, it's just a simple story, a very human story about actually recognizing peace when it's right here in front of us. And as I said, this story made me think of a story from the Buddha. I don't think he actually talks about it, Thich Nhat Hanh, in this particular chapter. And you may recognize this story. I'll just go ahead and start it, and I won't explain too much about it ahead of time. But it's a story from the Pali Canon, which is, the Pali Canon is a set of original teachings in different sections, and then one of the sections is a section of sutras, which are recorded sayings, discourses of the Buddha. So the Buddha will have interactions with different people, and it's a voluminous record, this original set of teachings. And this is just one story from that collection of sutras or discourses of the Buddha. And there's three characters in this particular story. The Buddha, Ananda, who is the Buddha's attendant, actually his cousin, so somebody who is a fellow practitioner. And then another person, a peer of the Buddha and Ananda, his name is Agivasana. So the story starts out, Ananda saw Agivasana coming at a distance and said to the Buddha, "Venerable sir, here comes Agivasana, Nagatha's son. He's a debater, a clever speaker, regarded by many as a sage. But he wants to discredit the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. It would be good for you, Buddha, if you could sit down for a while out of compassion for him." So this person joins Buddha, and then they have a bit of a conversation. And Agivasana talks about what other monks are doing at this particular time. He's kind of elaborating on what he thinks these monks' understandings are, what their practices are. He's got different critiques for them and so forth. But the Buddha asks Agivasana, "But Agivasana, what is your understanding of body and mind?" So Agivasana kind of explains a little bit more about what he sees in the current practices. And generally that was practices of austerity. And he's kind of just, again, giving his opinions on this. And then from there, the Buddha offers his teachings to Agivasana. He says, usually encountering a pleasant feeling, a person craves after pleasure and continues to crave after pleasure. That pleasant feeling inevitably ceases. With that sensation of the pleasant feeling, a painful feeling arises. Touched by that painful feeling, that person sorrows, grieves, laments, and becomes distraught. So the Buddha is presenting both pleasure and an undesirable situation. So very much a human predicament. And he's, I think, indicating to us that we can see craving as something that is very much a human quality as well. Even with pleasure, he's talking about there, right there with the pleasant feeling, we crave that it continues. There's a desire for it to persist. And then the Buddha continues, he says, with any pleasant feeling that has arisen, it garners our full attention, and it remains because it's being grasped. And when a painful feeling has arisen, that also garners our full attention and remains because there's a grasping of mind. So here the Buddha's talking about a pleasant feeling, and when that's happening, it is occupying our mind. It's something that we've identified as something pleasant, and it's something that we want to continue. Or a painful feeling, that as well garners our full attention. It's something that we want to go away. So the Buddha's talking about sort of the objectification of the things that we like or dislike. And of course, when we think about something, that's where the dissatisfaction really arises. So I think that's part of what's being talked about here. When we identify something, and it's kind of in this sutra a little bit, that things turn into dissatisfaction when that inclination or that preference comes about. So I think the Buddha is kind of hinting at, in a way, Thich Nhat Hanh's story of maybe the rain, you know, something that we could have an opinion about. If we're caught in the rain, it could be very, you know, something that we dislike. Or it could be like Thich Nhat Hanh is speaking of, you know, just joy, basically. So when the thinking gets into the mix, then we have the preference, and all of a sudden rain, which, you know, could be either way, can end up being something that is dissatisfying or undesirable. It's kind of funny in the story, as I indicated before, this character is a bit of a curmudgeon, I guess, in some ways. So in the sutra, he says, "I suppose you have full understanding then, Buddha." So kind of like a sarcastic moment here in this ancient teaching. But the Buddha says, "Surely, Agavasana, your words are discourteous, but I will nevertheless kind of continue to elaborate a little bit." And then the Buddha from there, he lays out a picture of what his journey has been to Agavasana. His years of wandering and really pondering, what is this craving, or what is human suffering? In light of the pleasure and dissatisfaction that comes up in human life. So the Buddha talks about his quest and sort of presents this as a hypothetical in some ways to Agavasana. He says, suppose that in my quest to resolve craving, I engaged in stringent techniques. I clenched my teeth and pressed my tongue against the roof of my mouth and constrained myself trying to suppress mind with mind. Or suppose that I started a practice of severe austerity, taking little food, a handful each time, my body reaching a state of extreme emaciation, so my limbs would become like jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems, so little food that my ribs jutted out as a gaunt as the crazy rafters in an old roofless barn. And he did partake in those particular practices, and he said that such painful feelings arose in him, but he was engaged in such strenuous concentration that the usual preferences of pleasure and pain didn't necessarily consume his mind like it normally would. So there was a strong concentration in that, but the Buddha recognized that there was no peace in what he was doing. He was just kind of following what other people were doing in the particular traditions of the time. And the Buddha said, "Whatever recluses and Brahmins of the past have experienced, their painful and racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost, and there is none beyond this." So he was saying that the level that he reached with these levels of austerities, asceticism, refraining from eating, anything beyond this would have been to starve oneself. So he's just saying that it would not be possible to take this any further than what I have. If you thought that this was some sort of solution to understanding human suffering, you couldn't take it any farther than what I have. And he said, by these racking practices and austerities, I have not attained any true understanding or any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. And then at this point in the sutra, in the thing that really grabbed my attention for this particular teaching, and when I really reflect on the moment in this sutra, the Buddha sort of pauses and he asks a question that for me is, it's kind of, I mean, not to overstate it, but it's kind of a monumental insight that occurred to the Buddha. He asked himself, could there be another path to enlightenment? He found a dead end, basically. And then I thought, you know, what would we do at this particular point in our practice if we were faced with a similar type of situation? You know, maybe we would think we just need to come up with some more concentrated way of understanding, some special technique or something more strenuous in order to sort of whatever our idea would be, break through to some sort of new understanding. But the Buddha did almost the exact opposite. He said, I considered something. I recall that when my father, the Shakyan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from excessive distraction, I entered upon a sustained calm, a single activity of quietude. So the Buddha, after these severe austerities, questioned himself, is there a way? Is there a different way? And he remembered this experience of being a child sitting at the edge of a field, just a calm, quiet, warm day, and a sense of peace just in this simple experience of sitting there on the earth. So it's, I use the term monumental there in the sense that there's kind of a revolutionary idea here, not in the sense of what we normally think of the revolution as like upheaval or something like that, but a turning of understanding, almost like a 180 degree shift from trying to transcend to understanding that something very simple is at the core of what this teaching is. The truth of everyday experience, not trying to get out of the world and transcend into something special, but this clue of his memory as a child, this very everyday experience, he said, could this be the path to enlightenment? Then following that memory came the realization, this is indeed the path to enlightenment. So as I say, this one little sutra, it has a recollection of the Buddha coming to a new understanding. He said, why am I afraid of that pleasure, that unadorned quietude? In other words, why would one escape this natural calm? Again, this recollection of being at the edge of a field. Why would we want to escape that using these severe austerities or strenuous activities of trying to achieve something or transcend? He said, I'm not afraid of that. Who would be, essentially? And what I'm thinking he's saying here is that all we really need to pick up this practice, we don't have to do strenuous activities. All we need is a simple, suitable place and just a simple effort of single-mindedness. I think of Thich Nhat Hanh's phrase, not thinking of the past or the future or anything at all. And the single-mindedness in meditation practice would just be simply following the breath, being here with the breath. Very simple, very human activity. The Buddha said, I considered it is not possible to find calm with a body so excessively emaciated. Now, when I had eaten solid food and regained my strength, I diligently engaged in concentrated awareness with a single activity of mindfulness. And here I think he's saying that this simple practice is a way to open up the possibility of kind of going back to what he was saying before about just the usual human situation where something pleasant arises or something painful arises, it garners our full attention. You know, it's right there. It's that object, that thing that I want to go away or I want to change or something like that. With this simple, single activity of awareness, we can open up the possibility where that doesn't necessarily need to garner our full attention. Again, we're not trying to stop that, but the simplicity of the practice, just being here, allowing awareness to arise, is that opportunity. And very much different than the unpeaceful situation of this his previous attempts, the strenuous, painful austerities. This simple activity is, again, an opportunity to understand peace. Of course, meditation, as we all know, is not always a peaceful activity, but the main aspect of this story is just to recognize the different ways that we kind of short circuit an opportunity to sort of clearly see the opportunity of peace. So the Buddha is talking about all kinds of different ways that you could try to, you know, the different activities that we may engage in this area. But being here, living our life, and being here for the peaceful moments or the sorrow, just remaining here with that, with this human experience, is just the truth of experience as it's happening. It's never what we think it is. You know, we'll have all kinds of different ideas and preferences. But if sorrow was coming up, we can just be here and not label that at all. Just take care of ourselves, take care of other people as best we can, and not try to transcend anything. At the end of this discourse, the Buddha said, when the talk is finished, Agavasana, then I steady my mind, quieten it, bring it to a singleness, and concentrate on the same as before. So it was kind of reminded me a little bit of there's a Suzuki phrase, when my talk is over, your listening is over. The Buddha says here, when my talk is finished, just come back to the single-mindedness, basically. Don't kind of similar to what Bo was talking about last Wednesday. We don't need to remember and process and like make sense of some you know, make something into a theory that we're going to carry out. We can just set this down when the talk is finished, single-mindedly come back and be here in this moment for tying our shoes or turning the key in the car, anything that we're doing. Again, just being here for the human experience. We hear the term truth, I think, and the term truth is so often related to like the truth of the word written down, or just trying to think of the different ways, the truth of maybe science, like a theory that's explaining how sort of the mechanics of the world work, how we can kind of predict things happen in the physical world. But here, truth is speaking of, again, just that quietude of sitting at the edge of the field. The truth of rain coming down and touching our skin. The truth in the sense that what is there that needs any explanation at all? What theory would, you know, augment that or explain it at all? You know, it's just the truth of experience. That's really what the Buddha is getting at here. We were, I was up in the Boundary Waters recently, and I mean, there's just so many examples in life where experience can be very vivid. We were canoeing. We often kind of canoe next to the shoreline just because there's so much to see. Sometimes we'll kind of round a corner, and since we're close to the shore, we'll kind of sneak up on wildlife a little bit. And we came around one corner, and a family of otters, or at least a couple of otters, were right there. I don't know if we were more surprised or they were more surprised, but they, you know, did their dive, curling dive, and then came up a little bit and head pops up and kind of looks straight at us and sort of wondering what's going on. They'll dive again and come back up. At one moment, we were sitting on the beach, and two or three cedar waxwing birds came and landed right next to us because we were just quietly sitting there. I just bring up these examples in the sense that just being here with our life is enough. And just to settle into that and to understand the truth of experience, sort of set aside our usual notions of what we think truth is as a scientific truth, or, you know, an intellectual truth, but to see the undeniable quality of, you know, just hearing the breeze of, in the leaves kind of shimmering and moving. There's nothing that excels that. That is truth itself. Of course, I'm explaining these things, so even to put it into words is sort of to reduce what, you know, if I stop talking, the quiet of this room, you know, there's nothing that could ever touch that. And in, I did want to bring in Suzuki Roshi a little bit. He actually talks about in the chapter Repetition in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the Buddha's quest, some of those austere practices that the Buddha went through. So Suzuki says, in Indian thought and practice that was encountered by the Buddha, it was based on an idea of human beings being a combination of spiritual and physical elements. So here we hear about this practice where the practices of the time were an attempt to kind of transcend physical and gain a unity with a spiritual realm. And this is a simplistic explanation of Hinduism. As Suzuki says here, this may be too great a simplification of the Indian practice encountered by the Buddha. But nevertheless, actually, many of us, he's essentially saying that many of us still kind of do this in a lot of ways. We take up an austere practice. So in the back of our minds, there's this kind of asceticism that can kind of go on where we're doing the same. We got this inclination of transcending, same kind of feeling that's going on. Obviously, we're not taking it to the level of what the Buddha and his peers were doing in terms of that practice, but you know, what is that? I think it's important just to recognize the quality of trying to, or the sense of overcoming something or transcending or going after something that seems to be better. You know, we'll have different ideas of some special state or something like that. And none of that's bad or anything, but the practice, I think, is just to recognize that's kind of our usual tendency to approach things such as this. It doesn't seem like simply sitting at the edge of a field is enough. You know, it's like, what is that going to do for me? You know, how am I going to get to the next level just by seeing that? So it's pretty incredible that here, as we see the Buddha's story, he did the opposite of, I think, maybe what I would have thought of at the moment. Getting done with austere practices, I would have thought, gonna have to up my game in some way, gonna come up with something more intense. Basically, he went in against the stream completely, and I think it's hard to overestimate how big of a deal that is, really. Suzuki says that the Buddha's way was quite different. At first, he studied the practices of his time and area. He practiced asceticism, but Buddha was not interested in the elements comprising human beings, nor in metaphysical theories of existence. He was more concerned about he himself existed in this moment. So again, the rain, or sitting next to a field, this moment of experience. Suzuki says that was the Buddha's point. Suzuki goes on to say that bread is made from flour. How flour becomes bread when put in the oven was for Buddha the most important thing. In order to find out how dough became perfect bread, he made it over and over again until he became quite successful. So this repeated or regular practice. Suzuki says that was his practice, but we may find it not so interesting to cook the same thing over and over again every day. It is rather tedious, you may say. If you lose the spirit of repetition, it will become quite difficult. But it will not be difficult if you're full of strength and vitality. Anyway, we cannot keep still. We have to do something. So if you do something, you should be very observant and careful and alert. Our way is to put the dough in the oven and watch it carefully. Suzuki says, there is no secret in our way. Just to practice sitting meditation, zazen, and put ourselves into the oven is our way. There is no secret in our way, he says. And I think was drawn to these stories, Thich Nhat Hanh and the Buddha. Well, maybe we read some teachings that have a philosophical sounding aspect to them, but here we see stories where if you ask the question, what is the secret to this? Or what is, you know, you hear the story of Thich Nhat Hanh playing in the rain or the Buddha next sitting under the rose apple tree. And you ask the question, what is the secret of this? I think it really clarifies that there is no secret. I mean, what could we possibly say is the secret of the feeling of rain? You know, there's nothing behind what that is. The experience is exactly what the experience is. Suzuki says there's no secret. In Thich Nhat Hanh's story, he ends that particular reminiscing with another short paragraph. He says, growing up, eventually growing up, we began to worry about homework, the right clothes, the right job, and supporting our family, not to mention war, social injustice, and so many other difficulties. We thought our paradise was lost, but it was not. And I'll read again. He said, even though you and I can even today, you and I can return to this peace. Every time we breathe in and out mindfully, our true home is present right now. I thought this was in usual Thich Nhat Hanh fashion. He has a way of recognizing. I mean, if you look at this, at Thich Nhat Hanh's life story, it really is incredible what he had gone through with the Vietnam War and refugee problems, the horrific situations that he and his country people were facing. Yet you have this figure who can have a composure and communicate a peace and compassion, which I think really gives this story of simple human experience a true power to it, that we can actually, with this sustained, single-minded dedication to life, we can address the things that are happening in the world. We can really put our full energy in helping others and trying to take care of ourselves. So it really is in contrast to kind of what I think about even what the usual methodology would be. Say I'm thinking about a conversation that I would have with somebody, a political conversation or something like that. And right there, kind of this ascetic type of practice of trying to control, you know, it's just a similar version of that, where my viewpoints will come up about a particular political ideology and how strongly I may be holding to those, with the notion of like asceticism, trying to transform something. I'm trying to change the other person's mind and to just try to squash that would be another form of asceticism. So the practice again is this simple quietude, single-minded practice, and just to see the difficulty. There's plenty of opportunities to see how I myself end up stirring the waters more than I ever thought I was or noticed that I was. And right there, just in the noticing, I can pull back a little bit and see that, yeah, I'm not even really understanding what the other person is saying here. I'm just sort of overlaying, you know, I got a simplistic view of what they think. So many times, both ourselves and other people, we're saying things that don't really reflect what we're actually feeling anyway. You know, we're just sort of using political ideology to sort of give ourselves some sort of temporary comfort. So again, this simple practice, I think, is a way to let those things be revealed kind of in a gentle way. And again, Thich Nhat Hanh is a complete embodiment of that open-mindedness and flexibility, where you can see a magnanimity coming out through the practice itself. So Suzuki says, actually, this is in a slightly different area related to, I thought it was related again to the tendency to kind of want to control, again, this sense of austere measures or trying to transcend or whatever. He says, if you try to stop your mind, that will only be a burden for you. Do not try to stop your mind, but leave everything as it is. Then things will not stay in your mind so long. Things will come as they come and go as they go. So again, I mean, he says the phrase here, leave everything as it is. And I think that can be heard, and then we think, well, what about the problems in the world? Is that just to not do anything? I think we can see a subtlety of what he's getting at here. And it gets back to just seeing or noticing how we do tend to try to control things. That's very enticing for us. I think of in relation to trying to address issues in the world, I think about the people who are I'm most impressed with in terms of what I think ultimately the world needs. And it tends to be people who are very hands off, in a sense that they're not trying to get in there and manipulate things. Just the presence of people like that is a great influence for the rest of us. So I think that is related to leaving things as they are. We can do that, but then also be very here in this relative world to address whatever needs to be addressed. We have to make decisions moment by moment. But if we can do with a mind that has more flexibility, I think it just opens up a chance to have understanding for each other. So Zen is definitely not about transcending. I think it's actually to see through the notion of transcending. To look at our sense of control, how we desire to control, and just simply seeing it as a burden, as Suzuki is suggesting to us. And to notice that the ideal that we may be having or holding is going to remain nothing more than an idea. It may be provisional and helpful in some situations, but it'll be never more than that. Alternatively, our practice can just be to sort of sit underneath that rose apple tree and really stay here, come back or resume this practice of awareness. It may seem kind of boring, the repetition of it, as Suzuki talks about, but that's really what he's getting down to, is understanding the importance of a regularity, not only in sitting practice, but knowing that we can come back and to this moment in whatever situation is happening in our life. I always love that phrase that comes up in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's kind of peppered throughout the book. Suzuki says, do not be bothered by your thinking, which is, I love that one. It's so simple. And in some ways, it's kind of like, we can do that, you know? Just settle a little bit. And I mean, it's a challenge, definitely, at times, because really, you know, speaking from my own experience, the thinking that happens can be pretty strong and compelling. But I think he's speaking again to that soft touch type of understanding. Just don't be bothered by our thinking. Category says to pat your head, pat yourself on top of the head, and come back to this moment. So that's all I have. I thought there were a couple of nice stories there. I don't know if maybe some of you recognize that story of Buddha, the young Buddha there. It gets brought up in certain teachings and books and stuff. It's kind of a famous little story. I was going to say parable, but it almost makes me think that, you know, I always wonder about some of these really old teachings, whether it was an actual event, so to speak. And it seems so practical and such a turning point. I think, you know, I can now imagine that kind of being as a historical event, which is just like, I put it next to other historical events, and it's just kind of like, it's incredible to think, if that hadn't have happened, would we have the teachings of the awakened right now? Which is really quite incredible. But that's just me. I don't need to, I tend to maybe talk about it a little too much. But does anybody have any thoughts or questions or comments at all? Yeah, Bo.
Yeah, that's really good.
Oh, we're going to send you the mic so Zoom folks can hear you. Yeah.
Yeah, so thanks for your time. I really enjoyed it.
Sure.
I hadn't thought that way of the revolution that probably was at that point in time. Today, how revolutionary in a way this practice is so counter to our usual way of going after something or transcending. I had that idea of transcendence in that way, the way that you put it before. And so it reminded me, of course, of either backwards step and turn of inward kingdom make the self. You know, and so I think it's a lot of our attention's point to this stuff. I think that that's what I was going to say. But just for this, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed it. You know. But I do treasure. Actually, this is the other thing I was going to say. I've been reading Dogen's show, Gatso, in the first chapter in his translation. I did notice that one of the words that he used was transcendence. And I don't know if this is like a translation type of thing, but I've read it a couple of times. And it seemed like they were using the word transcendence in its usual way, transcend, you know, to like a different state in some ways. So I don't have more to say on that, but I think it would revisit that and make clarity by that. I think it's probably my misunderstanding of what's being pointed out.
Yeah, I know what you mean. The term does come up every once in a while, transcend. And I think it may actually be in here, because you kind of get terms like that in some of the older sutras. But to your point, I think is what is really meant I think it's probably, you could use the term transcend in some ways, but I think Suzuki said something like, it's not the words that I say, it's the spirit in which I say it, which, because like Katagiri uses the phrase, the source of existence, which in some ways would not be something that you would normally use, because it could insinuate permanence or something like that. But the way the spirit and how he uses it works. So I think, you know, there's some latitude to use these different terms, but as long as the opportunity is just to see how, if we do see it as getting away from, you know, what's happening now, just seeing that as a burden, as Suzuki was saying. And but translations can be kind of, use, they choose different words, obviously, in different situations, but this particular moment, as you're saying, revolutionary, whatever term we would use there, I think of the human endeavor through time, and even now, something that's very revealing is the sense, or is this recurring thing that we say that we're in seek of happiness. And that's very revealing to me. That is admitting that there is something that is a bit out of kilter. You know, we don't say we're all happy, you know. There's like we recognize something there. And then you kind of think about the history of humanity, and really that's what we've kind of been doing the whole time, seeking to make ourselves comfortable, which is very, you know, there's nothing wrong with any of that, or we kind of want something better. It's just how we do things. But so all this really is about these teachings, is just to see, does it really work? So it's just this kind of, as I said, like whatever monumental thing, it's just like a monumental moment of honesty to slow down and recognize there's something that we can do about this. And we definitely don't need to beat ourselves up about anything, about, you know, how we've been doing things, or that we're craving, or anything like that. Just a moment of sincerity, and to know that our practice can actually be that same exact type of sincerity. So recognizing it and then continuing this single-minded sincerity, really does not need to be any more complicated than that, which is a breath of fresh air. You know, who wants to make things complicated? It's just like, this is really kind of nice to hear this. You don't have to jump through hoops and all kinds of different stuff. So yeah, thanks, Bo. Great. Jay? The Shobo Genzo. That's a, are you going to read through the whole thing, or it's probably worth reading the whole thing if you can.
Yeah. My goal at this point is to just try to understand his writing style.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. It's a jewel for sure.
Jay? I liked your comparison or the use of austerity and like getting your mind set on one particular thing and how that can be a sort of austerity. I never really thought of it that way. It made me think of, there was a point in my life where I felt like I needed to make a change in my educational path to do something that was very, you know, low impact. I have a technology background, and I was at this period in my life where I felt like that wasn't helping the environment and so forth and so on. I had a teacher, and he was a mechanical engineering teacher in the environmental sciences, and he said, I was kind of just firing all these questions at him, and he said, I have friends who are, you know, back to the lander, Luddite, off-grid, and, you know, he said, you know, I understand that perspective, and he said, But without modern technology, my son would be dead. You know, he made it that stark, and it kind of it allowed me to see where I was, you know, taking this extreme, you know, view of things, and I think that kind of speaks to what you were saying with there was that austerity that there was only, I have to just run myself down this.
Yeah, that's a good example.
So yeah, I appreciate that comparison.
I hadn't thought about that. It's almost like if we do really have a concern for it to stay in this world of, because I kind of have those impulses too, just sort of separate myself. But yeah, thanks for that. That's a great example of sort of can be a little bit of escapism there. I know I've felt that before. But then just to notice it, and there's probably some really beneficial things for people to try to do those things too. It's kind of like you can't say that one is the ultimate way. Having more people going back to the land is just a tremendously great thing too. So, yeah. Yeah, thanks for that, Pat.
Okay. I've had my hand raised.
Go ahead. Is it Daniel, did you say, on Zoom? Yeah, you can go ahead and ask your question.
Yeah, sure. First of all, I thought this was an excellent talk, so thank you very much for all of that.
Thanks.
The question I have is, you talked about, you know, coming back to the breath, you know, to use my own languaging, and just being with the breath, and just being as things arise and as they're coming up. Did I get that correctly?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So if someone's going through immense suffering and it doesn't look like it's really going to go away anytime soon, and being with the breath seems like it doesn't do much to assuage that suffering, what is it, again, maybe you've already said this, but what do you like recommend in moments like that? I mean, is it like have faith that just being with the breath is something that, and I realize to grasp on that something good will come out of this or something like that. I realize there's paradoxes here, but I don't know if you could respond if I was clear enough and, you know, even talk about, you know, if there are paradoxes, like what, you know, what they are.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks. I don't have too much to say besides maybe when I say coming back to this moment would not exclude just our ability to try to take care of ourselves. So I don't want to give the impression that single-minded activity would be sort of just trying to stop the usual stuff that we do. So I think there's ways that we use the kind of relative thinking in order to, you know, again, take care of ourselves and other people. So the practice is, again, just a gentle practice. And just so often we'll think about something and then we'll just kind of keep thinking about it, maybe acting on it, and we never really sort of slow down a little bit. But I think we can do that, come back to this moment. But then, you know, if difficulty is continuing, we got to navigate our world too. So just coming back to this moment and, you know, continue to use relative thinking to address our situation in the most healthy way that one can. So I guess all I would say there is, for me, it just is a way to provide an opportunity to just have a bit more softer touch, I guess. I used that before, but that's really maybe all I'm saying there. So yeah, we gotta, you know, it's don't want to try to control anything too much or make it into single-mindedness into something particular. You know, we got to live our life and pay attention to the practical side. So I'm not sure if that quite answers your question, but thanks for the question. We're a little bit over. We can talk more later too. That is an excellent question. So hopefully I answered a little bit there for you, Daniel.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. All right. Thanks for the questions. Great seeing everybody. We're a little bit over, so we'll see you next time. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.